This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Sunday that resumption of trade talks between the United States and China is a very big deal, but he acknowledged there is no immediate prospect for an agreement between the world's two largest economies. The talks will go on, he says, for quite some time. He's telling Fox News on Sunday. He said the countries had reached agreement on 90% of a new deal by early May before talks actually broke down and what has turned out to be a seven-week stalemate. U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed Saturday on the sidelines of the Group of 20 economic summit in Japan to start the renegotiations. But Kudlow assessed that the last 10% could be the toughest, with such unresolved issues as cyber attacks, Chinese demands. And of course, Kudlow assessed that the last 10% would be the toughest. Mr. Trump agreed in his meeting with Xi to ease sales of some U.S.-made components to Huawei Technologies, a policy change that some of Trump's Republican colleagues have criticized and disagree because they contend that Huawei can insert Chinese intelligence eavesdropping chips in the consumer products sold overseas. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida called it a catastrophic mistake. At least five people have been killed with dozens of people injured, according to Sudanese doctors, as protests continue over control over the African nation. Tens of thousands of protesters rallied across the country Sunday, calling for a civilian government nearly 3 months after the army forced out the long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir. This is VOA News. Some U.S. Democratic leaders are not lauding President Trump's third meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after Mr. Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to actually enter North Korea Sunday, stepping across the border during the meeting at the demilitarized zone. After shaking hands with Kim, Trump walked across the military demarcation line separating the two Koreas. Kim and Trump then crossed the border back into South Korea. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says President Trump is criticizing him for saying that it was a great honor to meet with Kim.
To say it's an honor to meet such a brutal dictator, that's not what presidents should do. Something is wrong the way this president conducts foreign policy.
It is the third meeting between Kim and Trump following talks in Singapore last June and in Vietnam in February, though the DMZ summit raises hopes of revived nuclear talks. It is not clear how much progress was actually made. As a show of solidarity, there have been protests around the world, including some in the United States, to support those in Sudan fighting for their independence. VOA's Jason Patinka followed a demonstration in Chicago.
Amin El Said, a Sudanese-American student, helped organize the Chicago protest.
We're standing with our brothers and sisters in Sudan right now who are gathering for a million-man march to once again stand up against an oppressive and brutal military regime that's been in power for over 30 years. We want the world to know that what's happening in Sudan cannot go unnoticed. People are dying. People are giving up their lives for basic human rights and basic freedoms.
Sunday marks the 30-year anniversary of a military coup in Sudan that ended democratic rule and brought dictator Omar al-Bashir to power. Bashir's regime was accused of corruption and human rights abuses, including an alleged genocide in the country's Darfur region. Bashir's military ousted him in April after mass protests, but the generals refused to hand over power to a civilian government.
Anti-government protesters in Hong Kong blocked main roads early Monday to limit access to a ceremony marking the anniversary of the city's handover to China. Senior officials from Hong Kong and mainland China are attending the annual flag raising on the 22nd anniversary of the handover July 1, 1997. Pro-democracy activists have called for a march, as they have on every anniversary. This year, the march, expected to be larger than usual because of the widespread opposition to a government proposal that would allow suspects to be extradited to mainland China to face charges. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, July the 1st, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. A Sudanese doctors group says that five people were killed and many others injured in a day of demonstrations against the military rule in Sudan. Tens of thousands of protesters rallied across the country Sunday, calling for a civilian government nearly 3 months after the army forced out President Omar al-Bashir.
Just people from my little town, Al-Hajjuz in Bahri, there were over a million people, like over a million people. You can't even see the end of the crowd. It is just a lot of people.
That was Rudwan Dawood, one of the organizers of the weekend protest in Sudan. The International Organization for Migration says that more than 32,000 migrants worldwide have died or gone missing between 2014 and 2018, with most fatalities occurring on the deadly Mediterranean Sea, crossing from North Africa to Europe. And the government of Uganda has approved a bill that will require that all citizens have health insurance.
Globally, donor financing is reducing, and so countries have to identify ways of domestic resource mobilization.
Sara Byachika Cheyamo is a commissioner of planning and finance in Uganda's Ministry of Health. We have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Off in Sudan, where tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of the capital Khartoum and other provincial towns in the country in demonstrations calling for the transfer of power from the military to civilian rule. Protest organizers said that this is most likely the largest mass protest in the country's history. It was also the first mass demonstration since the deadly crackdown by Sudan's security forces on June the 3rd. Rudwan Dawood is one of the organizers of the weekend protest. He's a political activist with the group Sudan of the Future Campaign. I reached him in Khartoum and asked him if he had an estimate of how many people attended yesterday's mass protest.
Jackson, there is no way that you can even estimate. Just people from my little town, Al-Hajjuz in Bahri, there were over a million people, like over a million people. You can't even see the end of the crowd. It is just a lot of people. It is unprecedented.
Protests happen in different cities. Where were you today? Where were you protesting from?
Yes, in every major city. Khartoum had the largest protest, but also there were protests in Al Jazeera, in the center of Sudan, eastern Sudan, in Red Sea State, Gadaris, Kassala, and there is in Abra, up north, and just all over Sudan.
So according to some of the reports that I've been reading, and some activists saying that yesterday's protest is perhaps the biggest protest in Sudan's history. As organizers, how were you able to mobilize the people, given that the internet has been shut down in the country? There was fear also for a military crackdown. How were you able to mobilize people?
To be honest, Jackson, even myself, I was surprised. Even though I'm one of the organizers, we have done a lot. The past few days, we have been painting on the walls, on the streets, inviting people and asking them to come out in June 30th, which is today. And we have been distributing flyers. We have been text messaging. The internet has been like blacked out by the government. That is why we each have little fear that some people may not be able to participate, because they may not even hear about, you know, our protest today. But surprisingly, the entire nation were out on the streets protesting. The crowds, again, were very, very big. I was surprised. I was called by the cell phone to document these historical days, and I got tired because the mass of the people will never end. You cannot see the beginning, and you cannot see the end of the protest. It was surprising for the military council. It was surprising for the opposition groups. It was surprising he made us happy, all of us, as Sudanese people.
Now, this is the first mass demonstration since the deadly crackdown by security forces in early June. Were you worried about the kind of reaction that would come from the military? For example, that there would be violence directed at protesters.
It's still, I cannot call them, you know, they were friendly. They were not. Because, you know, at the end, we had at least seven people who got shot. And this is according to the health minister. And they run this minister, of course. But overall, it was good. But what I believe is they had no option. They couldn't really, you know, like, face people with violence because they were so peaceful. I've never seen even one single protester throwing a rock or even saying any provocative thing. It was very peaceful, well-organized, and it was surprising. And also in the morning, like, for example, in Al-Hajj Yusuf area in Bahri, we had to talk to the generals from the rapid support forces and also some big officers from the police. We told them, you are our brother. We are your brother. You are our friend. We know each other. We are going to do this process peacefully. So please, don't ever try to shoot us or hurt us because you're hurting your own brothers at the end.
That was Ridwan Dawood, a political activist with the group Sudan of the Future Campaign. He was speaking to me from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Ethiopia and the African Union have offered a combined plan that calls for a civilian majority body, which the generals say could create a basis for new negotiations. The International Organization for Migration says that more than 32,000 migrants worldwide have died or gone missing between 2014 and 2018, with most fatalities occurring on the deadly Mediterranean Sea crossing from North Africa to Europe. The UN Migration Agency says that its global figures underestimate the true nature and extent of the problem, as many migrant deaths are never reported and many bodies are never recovered. Nevertheless, researchers say that the statistics paint a very grim picture of the perils awaiting hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants risking their lives in search of protection or a better life.
Despite the conflict in Yemen, people continue to attempt the sea crossing from the Horn of Africa across the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. At least 125 people drowned off the shores of Yemen in 2018, compared with 53 in 2017. And an increasing number of deaths on the United States-Mexico border have been recorded each year since 2014. The total we have over the 5 years is 1,907.
That was IOM spokesman Joel Millman. And the government of Uganda has approved a bill that will require compulsory health insurance by all citizens. Officials said that the National Health Insurance Scheme will generate resources to improve health services in the country. But some analysts are skeptical, saying that the government of Uganda should rather concentrate on improving health infrastructure in the country before they introduce the scheme. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji filed this report from Kampala, Uganda.
Dr. Sarabyachika Chewayama, a commission of planning and finance in the Ministry of Health, says the mandatory national health insurance scheme will help generate resources to improve the health sector in the country.
Globally, donor financing is reducing, and so countries have to identify ways of domestic resource mobilization. And health insurance is one of the ways which has been used all over the world to mobilize domestic resources for health. Uganda has been one of those unique countries where we still provide, government provides some free health care, but elsewhere it's not sustainable.
According to Uganda's Minister of Health, only 2% of the population have health insurance. Biachika says these are mainly people that are employed by the government, NGOs, and big commercial enterprises. Consequently, she says, citizens are usually in desperate situations as they seek medical treatment. For example, she says, sometimes they are forced to sell off their properties once a family member gets sick. Biachika says once citizens are insured, they will get better health services at affordable prices. Shamim Nachidiowa works for NGO Center for Media Literacy and Community Development, or CEMCOD, calls it a joke. She says the government cannot impose compulsory medical insurance to a population that is economically disabled.
Because if one cannot afford one meal a day, then I don't know how one can afford to insure themselves of the sickness that they've not even yet got. People are sleeping under trees. If one cannot afford to get grass and come up with a grass-thatched structure, how do you expect them to insure themselves?
Kakai Zerida, a member of Alliance for National Transformation, or NT, a new political party in Uganda, says the government should concentrate on building new hospitals, equipping medical staff, and buying medicines before they introduce a compulsory health insurance plan.
You cannot give what you do not have. You are saying we are going to get better health services by maybe contributing towards the medical bills. But one, you do not even have the facilities. You do not have the infrastructure, the buildings. Let's start with that. You do not have the doctors, the equipped doctors, because some doctors are in these healthy facilities without even the basics like gloves. And you find a woman who is giving birth dying because of just gloves of 1,000 Ugandan shillings.
Barofono Pondo, Uganda government spokesperson, insists that once introduced, every Ugandan will be compelled to have a health insurance policy.
Time is going to come when no school wants to take a child who is not fully insured in medical terms. That's other parts of the world, and we are going there.
The bill will be taken to Parliament for debate in coming days. Officials say once approved, they work with other medical insurance programs in other East African countries so citizens can access medical care whenever they travel. For VOA News, I am Mogume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
For decades, Kenya has exported avocados mainly to Europe and America. But in April, Kenya signed a trade agreement with China that will see Kenyan avocados exported to the Asian country. Kenyan avocado farmers plan to increase production in hopes of tapping the huge Chinese market. But as Rayel Ombu reports from Murang'a County, Kenya, there are many requirements that these farmers have to meet.
Kenyan farmer Alexander Mushiri tends to the 30 avocado trees he planted 7 years ago on his farm in Murang'a County. In previous years, most of his avocados were sold locally, providing a modest income for him, his wife, and 5 children. Then in April, Kenya signed a deal to export avocados to China, making Kenya the only African nation to sell the fruits to the huge Chinese consumer market. With that in mind, Mushiri says he will scale up production by planting more trees. He says if they plant more avocados, there'll be a market for them. In previous years, brokers will come, pick the larger fruits and leave the smaller ones on the farms with no one to sell to, says Mushiri, wasting lots of fruits. About 2 kilometers away from Mushiri's farm, Beatrice Mugore inspects her 300 avocado trees. She used to grow coffee on her 8-acre farm, but switched to avocados a few years ago as the price of coffee dropped and the market for avocados expanded. Her avocados are about 3 years old, says Mugore, and are her first fruits. She says potential buyers have come to her farm several times to check the avocados and pick samples, and they will be coming back for the harvest. The potential buyers Mugure is talking about are private exporting companies. Kenya's Ministry of Trade says that the Chinese market will take in over 40% of Kenya's avocado crop, putting Kenya in the top rank of avocado exporters. But there is one catch, says Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Trade and Industrialization, Peter Munya.
If you want to export something outside a standard that you have to meet, and they came to assess the situation of avocado, there was found to have some flies that made it very difficult for us to export raw avocado, and a stopgap decision was made to have frozen avocados be exported.
Farmers or traders are required to freeze the fruits to negative 30 degrees Celsius to get rid of the pests and negative 18 degrees for transit. Many farmers worry that the strict requirements will prevent them from directly exporting the produce. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Murang'a County, Kenya.
And from Kenya, we go to West Africa in Nigeria, where President Muhammadu Buhari has promised workers that his administration will ensure swift implementation of the minimum wage. The government and labor groups recently agreed to increase the minimum wage from $50 to $82 per month. The president also called on state governments as well as private institutions to implement the minimum wage. This, he says, would form part of the effort to encourage workers to contribute to the country's development. For reaction to the president's call, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Dr. Peter Ozo Esson, the General Secretary for the Nigeria Labour Congress.
We do believe that the implementation will take place soon because we have people representing us in a committee that is negotiating the consequential adjustments to the salary table for federal workers. And as of yesterday, the report we have is that progress is being made. And hopefully they will soon conclude that negotiation. Once that is done and the implication for the salary table is determined, then we do expect that the implementation will take place. So we are positively waiting for that development. And the president says so. We believe it is true.
Are you anticipating good faith negotiations? Because previous negotiations have seen accusations and counter-accusations from both labor and the administration.
Well, you know, this negotiation is slightly different from the minimum wage negotiation, which dragged on for a long time. Because now that the minimum wage has been agreed and determined that it is law, it is the implication, what we call the vertical relativity on the salary table, that adjustments need to be made up.
And our next story takes us to East Africa in Rwanda, where young comedians and entrepreneurs are using humor as an antidote to stress and pain while creating a niche in the country's budding entertainment industry. Reporter Michael Mujisha looks at the growing entertainment industry with focus on comedy. Almost 10 years ago, four comedians created a collective they named Comedy Nights in the country's capital, Kigali. Their hope was that their form of art would bring about laughter and relief in a country that had seen one of the worst genocides in recent history.
It started with an idea, a challenge, and an opportunity for four young Rwandan comedians to create a business of laughter in a country that was recovering from a genocide. That idea is what grew into a popular social gathering known as Comedy Nights. Jerome Mejisha, one of the co-founders of Comedy Nights, he says that they started with a mission to bring back smiles and laughter at a difficult time in the country.
Our journey started in 2010 with the mission of bringing back smiles and laughter in our community because of our past. It wasn't easy. When we started, people were like, no, there's no way you can make a Rwandan laugh. And we actually did make them laugh. We started with 24, 25 people in the audience, but today we have festivals of thousands of people. And even you can check on social media, people are sharing jokes by themselves. They're even creating jokes, and they're not even comedians. They're creating to just laugh between each other. And that shows you the growth of comedy in Rwanda.
Comedian Babujo, one of the co-founders, currently serves as the vice president in charge of comedy at the Rwanda Performing Arts Federation. He says that the idea gained popularity around 2016. They took the show on the road, traveling to perform in festivals around the world. The Comedy Nights, however, saw a talent gap in the industry and decided to do something about it with the launch of a nationwide televised talent-steered show, The Com Factory.
The comedy industry has been growing steadily, very, very nice speed. We are now on a level where the masses, you know, may well have gone mainstream, and we've given a platform to so many comedians. Actually, every comedian that is working in the industry right now, we have worked with them. I mean Comedy Nights. And personally, my job was to, ever since 2017, my job was to support local talent and improve, give them a platform, train them. And what we did then is bearing fruit now, ever since the days of the TV show.
Michael Mjisha, reporting for Daybreak Africa.
Now time for Daybreak Africa Sports with our sports editor, Samson O'Malley. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson. We begin the sports in Cairo, where day 10 of the 2019 African Cup of Nations, currently on the way in Egypt, produced a shocking result for pre-tournament favourite, the Super Eagles of Nigeria. A catastrophic error from Super Eagles centre-back Leon Balogun and a sumptuous free kick from Carolus Andramahiti Sinyoro saw debutant Madagascar shock Nigeria 2-0 and finish top of Group B. The Islanders continued writing their beautiful story at the Total African Cup of Nations AFCON Egypt 2019, remaining unbeaten in the group stage matches to finish on 7 points. In his reactions shortly after the game ended, Super Eagles coach Gerald Ross said his side lost to a very good side.
And we miss this fighting spirit what showed us Madagascar. But, you know, when a team is already qualified in the mind, they play to play. To win, of course, but they don't have this volunteer, this desire, what I saw in the Madagascar team. So congrats to Madagascar. The next game for us is more important.
With the defeat, Nigeria finished second and will meet the second-place team from Group F in Alexandria next weekend. Elsewhere in Cairo, Guinea beat Burundi 2-0 in the other Group B clash. Guinea has 4 points and is hoping to finish as one of the four best third-placed teams. In the late kickoff in Group A, host Egypt ended Group A with maximum points after defeating Uganda 2-0 at the Cairo International Stadium on Sunday night, winning all three matches of their mini league campaign. Meanwhile, Uganda qualified to the round of 16, finishing the group phase in second place, 1 point more than DR Congo, who defeated Zimbabwe 4-0. The Leopards will now wait to see if they can grab one of the four places for the third placed teams. DR Congo thrumped Zimbabwe 4-0 in their final 2019 African Cup of Nations Group A match at the 30th June Stadium in Egypt on Sunday night. The victory saw the Leopards finish third on the group standings, and they could advance the round of 16 if the results in other groups go their way, while the Warriors crashed out of the tournament after finishing fourth. Yusuf Mulumbu, DRC midfielder, was ecstatic over their victory against the Zimbabweans.
We lost the first two games, and we put ourselves in a difficult situation, but we corrected today. It was a very important day today for us. It's Independence Day in Congo. So in front of our supporters, we really wanted to win. So we show determination, and we fought until the end. And I'm very happy from the reaction of my teammate.
Later today, four teams will be in action in Group C and D in their final group matches. All four games take place in Cairo, with Ivory Coast looking to get back to winning ways against Namibia in Group D, as South Africa aim to deny Morocco top spot. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Monday, July the 1st. And that's it for this Monday, July the 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford and our sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good week ahead, Africa.
Yes, just say yes to the weekend. Hi, everybody. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Let me help you maximize your weekend. If you tune in to your local station this Sunday, I'll take you on a beautiful, fun, and exciting musical journey across the continent.
We are so happy to be back and present our new single, Jelle, for you.
This Sunday features music and news from the Africa Cup of Nations and the BET Awards. You'll also hear Remy Ongala, Tinari Nwen, Susu and Maher Sisoko, Mr. Leo, traditional Mbira music by Jacob and Martha from Zimbabwe, and more. So maximize it. Listen to Music Time in Africa this Sunday and again the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Uh-huh.